donkey tendered to pull, and then saw the stiff was not clear but standing in the cable's bite. That had been Polo's mistake. He shouted to the drunk, who started a clumsy run, but the tangled haywire was still being drawn, and it snarled, kinked, went tight, and snapped. It lashed Multi's midriff with terrible force. The frightened stiffs helped him down to the bunkhouse, and there he lay with blood filling his mouth until 10 o'clock that night, when he died. It was only Lobert's cell, Edward Outker's oldest son, trained to be cautious, who returned from the West Coast to his family unscarred, unbroken, happy to be reunited with his brother Jim, happy to find a wife, to take up the business of fatherhood and life. Men could die in distant lands, as Aaron's oldest son John died across the ocean in trench mud in 1917, watching the slanting rain become the final mist. Men could die at home, as on the December morning in the same year when two ships, one packed with munitions and explosives for the war in Europe, collided in the Halifax Narrows, causing the world's largest explosion and a tsunami that wiped out the Mi'kmaq village in Tufts Cove. Among the mangled and drowned were Lobert's brother Jim Sell and four of his children. "We go Shubenacadie," said grieving and frightened Lobert to his pregnant wife Nanty, and they moved inland, to the reserve, though he never thought of the reserve as a safe haven. There they found a measure of balance, although they were poor. Lobert worked for a timber company in exchange for pay in logs, and used them to build a 3-room house. When his son, Edgar Jim Sell, called Egga, was born, he began to worry as his own father, Edward Outher, had worried over him. He did not want his sons to work in the forests, nor his daughters to clean house for white men women. He saw no danger in the residential school, though he did not like the man who came to the house with paper and pen and said if he did not sign the consent forms, his children would be taken by the welfare people. He signed. So, when Egga was 10 years old, he and his best friend Johnny Stick entered the residential school where Mi'kmaq children, their culture and language, suffered a 40-year implosion as deadly as any munitions ship. "You will get education, Egga. To read and write is important. You will get better work than cut trees," his father told him. And Lobert and Nanty visited him at the school every month, lugging a basket of home delicacies, smoked eel, Nanty's special bread, sardines and yellow cake. The priests and nuns smiled and spoke pleasantly. Lobert and Nanty were proud their son was getting an education, and because of that pride and because of the false sweetness of the black-clad religious, Egga could not tell them that he never attended a class, because the priests worked him all day long shoveling coal in the school's furnace room, where he learned to read only pressure gauges, that he was called a lazy savage, frequently kicked. After a hard beating by fat Father O'Hoopy that left him deaf in one ear and with a broken arm that healed badly, Egga knew he was a slave, not a student. Johnny Stick worked beside him. Johnny's people never came to visit, as they lived far away, and Johnny got rough treatment from the priests. He was often called to Father Blink's room. Every boy knew what that meant, as Father Blink, a hairy, ill-smelling man whose black dress captured and held every stink his body produced, had perverse needs, and those who did not satisfy them could expect beating, hunger, isolation, insults, hair-pulling, doors slammed on fingers, arms twisted until they hung loose and unusable, kicks and public humiliation, being shaken awake in the night, screams directly in the face, being burned with sulfur head matches. Tortures not just for days, not just for weeks or months, but for years. Father Blink prided himself that he never forgot a boy who refused him. Egga made a plan. He wanted to ask Johnny to come with him, but never found the private moment to ask, and he slipped away from the school on his own. Lobert and Nanty were awakened by thunderous pounding on their door. "Where is he? Your stinking bad son ran off. We know he's here. You are in serious trouble for this." They turned the log house upside down, looking for Egga, and came back at odd times for many months before giving up. Lobert and Nanty were miserable and now began to hear certain stories about the school. They had failed to protect their son from harm. They were not the only bereft parents. Many, when bad news came that their child had died after a long illness, accepted the lie. Not knowing what had happened to Egga, Nanty fell into a kind of prolonged sadness that took her to the grave, leaving Lobert with the blackest thoughts. For him, the evils of the residential school and lack of government oversight permanently stained any English-Canadian claim to decency. It was all words. Yet some hopeful spark still burned, and after the war, he married Kate Gugu. No one ever knew what Lobert had done, but when Paul, Alice, and Mary May went to the Resi school, they suffered scorn and name-calling, but were never beaten. Runaway Egga, the direct descendant of Charles Duquet and René Selle, half-starved and ragged, walked by night and slept by day. The only place he had in mind was south. He did not know where he was going except away from Canada. Attracted to watercraft, he stowed aboard a fishing boat headed for Rockland, Maine, slipped off the boat in darkness, and began to walk again. He followed the shoreline for many weeks, begging food or offering to work at farms he passed, slowly made his way to Barnstable, and because he smelled frying fish from the galley, begged a ride on a fishing boat headed to Martha's Vineyard. The fisherman gave him a hot chunk of scrod, and he was theirs forever. There were other homeless boys hanging around the docks where the fishing boats came in, running errands for the fishermen and helping unload fish. None of them were Mi'kmaq. Egga got his first real boat job learning to haul trap for weak fish and whiting. Captain Giff Peak, himself half Wampanoag, taught Egga how to read a few words, but watching the boy try to write was, he said, like watching a dog try to play the piano. Still, Egga was an eager worker, cheerful, every morning full of hope for a good day, as escaped or released prisoners sometimes are. Egga grew to adulthood aboard Captain Peake's boat, and when the old man retired to sit by his daughter's fire, Egga signed on to bigger boats with men who worked the rich cod waters of George's Bank. He put away his identification as Mi'kmaq and became a hybrid person. In the sweep of his 21st year, he volunteered for U.S. military service and was turned down as an alien resident, applied for citizenship, met, courted, and married Brenda, a Wampanoag girl. Years later, reunited with his father Lobert, he said, "What I loved about Bren right at the start was how fast she could count up. She was quick-minded with numbers and she could read right side up and upside down. She was working for the fish dealers, but I got her away from them. Yes, I did so. Everlasting joy." But their marriage wasn't easy. Bren had strong ideas and set them forward fearlessly. Egga, determined to master reading, set himself the task of making his way through the newspapers every day. He subscribed to several Nova Scotia newspapers, including the Amherst Daily and the Yarmouth Herald, and so he learned something of what he had left behind, and over the years, he and Bren talked about it. She had never been to Nova Scotia, but she had seen how it went with the Wampanoag. Sometimes Halifax men came down on fishing boats, and Egga invited them to supper and asked for news. In this way, they learned that between the wars, Mi'kmaq working men went to Winnipeg to harvest grain, to Maine to pick apples, did whatever they could find. They worked as stevedores, emptied and dumped stinking ballast from ships. Many of them lived in lumber camps, away from the reservation, except for occasional quiet visits to wives and children. "I know what that does to their traditional ways," said Bren. "When the men go away to work, it puts the responsibility for saving the language on the women." But it seemed that most of the women signed the papers sending their children to the residential schools, trusting they would be taught what they needed to live in the English culture. Few parents knew of the atrocities practiced on their boys and girls by genocidal nuns and priests. The children were never again wholly Mi'kmaq. Moulty Selle's grandsons, Blaise and Louis Selle, were loggers with chainsaws and heavy machinery. Trees were assembly line products. Every year there were fewer men on the ground, the place of injuries and death. Work was safer in the cab of a machine. They spread out, far distant from the reserve. The Mias and Sell brothers preferred tree-length logging setups, and some of them worked in Minnesota and Wisconsin, some in Maine, some in British Columbia or Washington and Oregon states. The old bunkhouse camps were gone. They brought up their families in white man houses, listened to the radio, ate at the diner, drove to work, and only went back to Nova Scotia for St. Anne's Day. They knew how their grandfathers had lived. Blaise Sell, one of Multy's grandsons, a skilled feller-buncher operator, said, "Them old camps? You couldn't get me in one of them damn rat hovels for no amount of money. Way the hell out in the sticks. Nothing to do but work and pick your nose." His brother Louis ran the grapple skidder, hooking onto Blaze's bundles of trees, dragging them to the landing, where they went through the delimmer which stripped the branches. He didn't wait to see the logs loaded into the slasher and cut into preset lengths, nor did he care to see them loaded and hauled away to the pulp mill, but hurried back to Blaze for a fresh bouquet of stems. It was a job. It put food on his family's table, paid for his pickup truck, for his and his wife Astrid's house. Other cells found jobs in the pulp and paper mills, in the plywood factories, in the cellulose acetate plants, moving deeper into the world of plastics. Noel Mias' youngest son, Chancey Mias, worked for an Inwoods chipping company. But he remarked to his wife Shelley that chipping at the landing robbed the woods. "If you don't put those back, soil start to decline. Should do some nutrient replacement work where we took the trees. Think the company will do that? I don't."
"That's a shame," said his wife vaguely.
As if to balance this neglect, his brother Jackson in Maine ran an old-style two-man horse-logging outfit, slow, hard work, fresh air, and enough danger to go around. Jackson cut the trees, and his neighbor partner, Sonny Hull, dragged them to the landing with his big draft horses. They had steady work from property owners who wanted a quiet operation that didn't rip up the land. But after a winter of almost no snow when Sonny Hull packed up and moved to Montana and the work was scarce, Jackson went back to school and earned a B.S. in forestry, kept going for a master's in wood management. He had never set foot on the old Mi'kmaq reservation at Shubenacadie, though he knew he had people there. It was something he was going to do someday, some St. Anne's Day. To the Sell and Mias relatives, St. Anne's Day had a value that outsiders could not understand.
"Worth the 3-day drive, if that's what it takes," said Blaise Sell, sitting relaxed and comfortable with second cousins and old aunties belonging to the Mi'kmaq people, if only for a day or two. His wife Astrid, the granddaughter of Swedish immigrants, never came with him.
"It's a little bit silly," she said. "You driving all that way, saying those Mi'kmaqs are your blood kin? It's not like you to do that."
But it was. Part 10. Sliding into Darkness. 1886 to 2013. 63. Perfidy. Scrawny Miss Heinrich still sat at the front desk, the office anteroom unchanged since the company's near collapse decades earlier. She would never forget how everything had fallen wrong. The Depression, when construction fell off and lumber prices dropped. Then, just as the timber business was recovering, lawyer Flentz disappeared with Annick Duncan and the embezzled funds. It was the logging company's worst time. What an uproar. Miss Lavinia had called in 4 special accountants, dark-eyed men with black mustaches.
"Miss Heinrich, could we please have the books for 73? Could we please have the board meeting minutes for the last 3 years?
Mr. Pye, aged and trembly, was called out of retirement to explain certain actions. The accountants spoke among themselves over dinner plates of steak and boiled potatoes. They strongly suspected that old Mr. Pye might have set the whole scheme going decades earlier and made his own nest comfortable. When the accountants were finished, they met with Dieter and Lavinia.
"Mr. Breitsprecher, Mrs. Breitsprecher, from the beginning,
Flentz had extraordinary powers to acquire properties for Duke Logging, and to sell. There was no contract that limited his actions on the company's behalf to acquisition. Yet he was an employee, not a partner nor a stockholder. There was nothing that prohibited him from wrongdoing except moral responsibility. I always believed he was loyal to me personally as well as to the company. I never doubted that. I counted him as a friend and I trusted him. We did business as a gentleman's agreement. My father operated that way and was never defrauded, said Lavinia stiffly.
This time you were defrauded. Flentz made secret sales of the company's woodlands, lumber barges, warehouse contents.
The accountants implied that the embezzlement was her own fault, that one's word counted for nothing. The chief accountant inclined his head a little and said,
Mrs. Breitsprecher, may I recommend you to read Adam Smith? It is a truism that men do only what they are rewarded for doing.
Flentz received a rather modest salary for his legal work on behalf of the company, and in future keep in mind, when doing business with Chicago lawyers, homo homini lupus est. Man is a wolf to man. They left Duke and Breitsprecher reduced to a skeleton staff and a lean future. The company staggered and nearly fell. It was hard times nationally. Stocks and land values plunged. Industrious brooms of change swept out the markets. Men were no longer grateful for work. Labor problems and strikes crippled every business, and the forests of the Northwest were flashpoints for rebellious forest workers who preferred better pay to manly poverty. The entire country was in an irascible, sour mood. Lavinia, wanting to rid herself and the company of anything touching on Flentz, voted with the remaining board members to relinquish the incorporation charter. When Duke was establishing itself as a major logging company, we needed capital to build logging railroads, to purchase lumber barges and steamboats, build roads. But all that has changed. Henceforth, we will return, although operating on a shoestring, to a sole proprietorship. Aside from all else, incorporation is better suited to canals and turnpikes, railroads and banks, not the timber industry, at least in the position we now find ourselves. A sense of being savagely cheated colored the atmosphere in the boardroom.
Lavinia, Dieter said as they went over the details of Duke and Breitsprecher's teetering position. We will weather this storm. It is true that the company has lost a great deal of its value, but enough remains that we can start over. Lavinia could barely speak for rage.
Dieter, my fortune, my lost fortune, came from the bonanza of Maine and Michigan lumber that we cut over the generations. No such rich woodlands exist these days. Flentz took my ancestral heritage.
But she exaggerated. Flentz had not touched her personal property, had not sold her Chicago land holdings, now worth millions. It was the company assets he had rifled.
My dear, please listen. The forests of the Northwest are even more prodigious than those of Maine or the Great Lakes country. All will be well in a few years if the company builds up its timber acquisition again, and we are free to focus on our conservation policies as never before. We shall make a new reputation, a new name for Duke and Breitsprecher.
But Lavinia was not consoled. Especially her heart burned at the thought of Annick Duncan's perfidy.
I trusted her, she said. I gave her a job when she had nothing, and this is how she repaid me. I cannot understand how she fell into Flentz's grasp.
She clenched and unclenched her hands.
Lavinia, did you never notice how attentive the lawyer was to her? He praised her cookies, brought her little bouquets, always had a smile and drove her home after long meetings. I believe she was smitten with his attentions. Neither I nor you praised her. We took her for granted. That was Flentz's opportunity. He rubbed his chin. And who can know? Perhaps he had an affection for her. She was a rather handsome woman. As soon as he spoke, he knew he should not have said this.
Indeed, cried Lavinia in a passion. I do not think so myself.
But oh, how I wish I could relive the years and keep a chain on his neck! And hers! However, I will engage Pinkertons to look for the guilty parties. I'll see them in prison." She composed herself. There was nothing to do but go on. "And you are right, Dieter. The forests of the Northwest are rich. If we can only get at the remoter areas, and we still have the Kauri forest land in New Zealand. Do you remember our promise to the Ovals not to clean-cut and run away, but to remove judiciously and replant? I wish now that my experiments with the Kauri seeds had flourished, but the soil conditions were inimical." Lavinia could not resist her nature, and sent orders to cut all the Kauri, sparing none. That cut would begin to rebuild her fortune. And Dieter was right. There was still much that remained. Flens had not touched the plywood mills nor the paper mills, and both were drawing in money like dry sponges. They would take advantage of the new technical advances and milling machinery. Duke and Breitsprecher would survive. "Our annual Inventors' Exposition must continue," said Lavinia. But the old Hotel Great Lakes had burned down. Lavinia tried to persuade the board that an exposition hall on company property would attract inventors. "We made millions with the boxed houses, and who knows what might come along these days when every man's head is whirring with logging machinery improvements? Let us use Mr. Jinx's old house and grounds as the central node. Participants will take pleasure in strolling through our little forest." But fewer inventors applied to the Duke and Breitsprecher exposition. Its day had passed. Men wanted to patent their ideas in their own names. Dieter felt, too, that the golden days of logging when the forest was endless were over. Farmers who had cut off, burned down, and worn out millions of acres of soil in the east were still rushing into the western timberlands to repeat their work, making huge pyres of prime trees and setting them alight, cursing when the scorched soil showed too rocky and poor for growing anything but weeds. He suffered through the last quarter of the century as again and again Congress congratulated itself on enacting a series of logging laws. Timber Culture Act, Timber Cutting Act, Timber and Stone Act, all supposedly aimed at conservation, but all written with more loopholes than a page of Spencerian calligraphy. "From what eggs do these fools hatch? They cannot see," cried Dieter. "The greatest ill is waste. Only a minuscule fraction of the standing forest ever becomes lumber. Most is burnt or abandoned. Mein Gott!" "It is laughable," said Dieter. "It is criminal. The infamous Landlieu clause that allows anyone to donate woodland to a protected forest in exchange for an equal amount of land somewhere else. Lumbermen love this clause that lets them swap their logged-off woods for acres of untouched timber. It makes me sick to see the way they send carloads of lobbyists to Washington to keep the good paydays coming. This is the real American liberty." His solitary breakfast hour was filled with exasperated sighing as he read of successive waves of scandal from real estate men to legislatures. But he said nothing of this to Lavinia. He knew she employed lobbyists. And by association, so did he. It seemed the two miscreants had gone in opposite directions. Month after month, Pinkerton reported rumors of sightings of Flens in Peru, Athens, Georgia, Glasgow, and Buenos Aires, but no actual hard evidence. "Keep on, keep on," said Lavinia, paying the steep monthly detective bills. Then came word that Flens had truly been tracked down to an alley behind the Mulo Rojo, a restaurant in Valparaiso, where he lay dead, stabbed and robbed. Of Annick Duncan there was no word. She had truly disappeared into the wilds of Scotland, where no stranger dared go. One roaring wet morning, the housemaid brought up Lavinia's pot of hot chocolate and trimmed toast. Lavinia was at the window, tying the belt of her rose silk dressing gown, looking out at the dark, wind-streaked lake.
"Good morning, ma'am. Another nasty day. Mr. Dieter complains of a catarrh."
"He had better stay in, then. I will look in on him after I dress." The maid put the tray on the little breakfast table, poured the chocolate, and left. Lavinia sat down, took up her cup, sipped once, turned to look out at the slanting rain, and collapsed, chocolate drenching her thighs. When the doctor came, he said heart attack. No one knew why these things happened. Sometimes people just died. As did Lavinia. Dieter's catarrh became a lingering pleurisy that immobilized him for 6 weeks. Yet he managed to rise from his sick bed and meet with the stonemason, for after a bit of tinkering, there was only one inscription for her stone. Call for the robin redbreast. Here lies a friend. She had made no changes in her will since the days before Annick Duncan's and Flens's Scarper, bequests of properties and wealth no longer in existence, made the reading of it painful to those who should have become wealthy, but instead found themselves with barely enough to live modestly. She left 11-year-old Charlie the greatest part of her fortune, which he could not touch until he was 40, the age of reason, in Lavinia's opinion. There was an odd addendum, that should a Canadian claimant come forth to seize a share of Duke Breitsprecher assets, that person should be resisted in every legal way. No one knew what this meant, but it trailed a black thread through the day. Dieter Breitsprecher, who seemed the ideal personality for a widower, surprised everyone by remarrying a year after Lavinia's death. His bride was the youngest daughter, Rala Henga, of a preservationist-minded timberman friend. The young woman with long chestnut-colored hair was 30 years younger than Dieter, and he treated her with elaborate courtesy as though she were a crystal goblet. She had a fluttery laugh, and none of Lavinia's robust strengths and mannerisms. The logging business did not interest her. Her hopes were all for children. And 18 months after the marriage, she bore a son, James Bardewolf Breitsprecher. More than a decade later, a daughter, Sophia Hannah, arrived, but no more. For Rala, she who had been so dainty and fragile, went into decline and died of stinking, oozing breast cancer before Sophia could walk, before James Bardewolf had reached his teens. As for Charlie, he had long before left home. Sixty-four. Loser. When he remarried, Dieter sold Lavinia's old place and commissioned Burnham's to build him a house in the newly annexed town of Edison Park. Classical in appearance, it presented a calm front to the world with its orderly paired windows. Inside, it was modern, wired for electric light and with two telephone lines. Dieter had sent Charlie to study forestry at Yale, where he ran upstairs three at a time, contradicted his professors. He was passionate about forests, but disappointed by the school's lack of similar enthusiasm. It was all about management. He went to Germany to see firsthand the results of 200 years of woodland supervision, but chafed under the lectures and begged Dieter and the board to let him travel and learn the ways of forests through observation. They agreed on a stipend, and he began a wandering journey. He looked at beechwoods and hornbeam, sought out the remnant chestnut groves of France, went to still extant shreds of boreal forest in Scandinavia, to the scattered pieces of pine and birch woodlands in Scotland, the awkward corners of ash, oak, and alder in Ireland and Wales. What preserved each was difficult accessibility. He took passage to Australia to see mutation-crazed eucalypts, to New Zealand where he was embarrassed by Duke and Breitsprecher's vandalism of the ancient Kauri, and used a pseudonym rather than give his name. In a nightmare, he had to lift and replace the fallen monsters on their bleeding stumps. But the day came when Dieter and the board called him back to settle what his future with the company should be. Returned to Chicago, he wandered around the city looking at the new skyscrapers, eating scrappy food from street vendors. His thoughts on forests were in shambles. He had seen too much, and now believed that a managed forest was a criminal enslavement of nature. His views were unpopular. Nothing he could do but wait until the hourglass turned. At breakfast one day, Dieter said, dithering over his eternal dish of smoked salmon and 2 poached eggs,
Your sister and brother will visit next week. James Bardewolf has a very handsome wife, Caroline. His law practice is doing well. You have...
They are not my sister and brother, Father.
Dieter ignored the interruption and went on.
Have not met Caroline.
The last time you were here, she was abroad with her mother. She and James Bardewolf have twin baby boys, Raphael and Claude, and Sophia married Andrew Harkis in January. Perhaps I already told you that. She is somewhat young, and I feel he will have a steadying effect. Harkis attended Yale Forestry School, by the way, and started working for us 4 or 5 years ago. He revived our cutting operations, got us into Ecuador for the balsa, and, after the Great Fire, into California redwood. He persuaded us to buy up a good deal of prime timber in the Oregon and Washington coasts. It seems the company is regaining its lost wealth.
What Great Fire do you mean?
By the Great San Francisco Fire after the earthquake. It destroyed every building 2.5 miles north from the railroad freight sheds. They say it burned half the city. Surely you saw stories about it in the papers, wherever you were.
No, I rarely read the papers.
The only buildings that survived were those constructed of redwood. Nothing could have better displayed its flame-resistant qualities. People demanded, still demand, redwood lumber to rebuild. Andrew accepted the challenge. He had men in the woods before the ashes were cold, and they worked every minute there was light to see. The mills ran 24 hours a day. Charlie faintly remembered Harkis, who had been in the Yale forestry program during his own short time there. Andrew is very ambitious about restoring Breitsprecher to its former position. He dedicates himself to its improvement in every way. With no irony, Dieter paraphrased Couet. Every day, in every way, he strives to become better and better.
Father, how do you feel about this logging enterprise? Better and better?
I give my support as we start replanting a year after they get out the cut. It is a balanced process.
I can't imagine what you think will replace 2,000-year-old redwoods. Scotch pine seedlings? And what of the diversity of species? What about the soil? Erosion? All those qualities you once cared about. Are you cutting old-growth fir and cedar and planting pine? You mentioned Oregon and Washington.
I suppose I have become more practical through years with Lavinia. So, cutting whatever grows along the shoreline. The big timber in rough country remains untouched. We can't get that out without the great cost of rails and engines.
What about the watershed protections? The hydrology will be severely compromised. I have been in that country. It is mountainous with steep slopes. And I know that not only redwoods, but those big cedars can swell out 20 feet across at the bottom. Your choppers likely have to use springboards, get up where the girth is 10 foot less. The waste must be prodigious.
Well, I suggest you talk to Andrew about that. He's the man with the axe.
Dieter laughed.
Oh, God, said Charlie at the thought of that dandified homme chic gripping an axe.
When James Bardewolf and Caroline arrived, the youngest son went straight to the sideboard and made himself a whiskey highball. He did not ask anyone else what they would like. That was for Dieter to do. Let him pour sherry, whiskey, more whiskey for Charlie. Old familiar tensions seeped into the room. Sophia and Andrew Harkis were the family showpieces. Andrew's even-featured red face and intensely blue eyes, his slender but muscular body gave him an advantage. Yet under the fashionable exterior, Dieter saw a hunger that made him think of a dog in the rain watching the master walk to and fro behind lighted windows. And there was James Bardewolf, baring his teeth in a caustic smile. His wife, Caroline, in a modish silk dress, Sophia very pretty. And Charlie in his worn tweed lounge suit and unpolished boots. His children, thought Dieter. His dear, terrible children.
So, Charles, you're paying us a visit, said Sophia.
She was a certain type of beauty with upright posture and pale hair, her young face ornamented by a beautifully shaped mouth. Do you object? He leaned forward, twiddled his fingers.
It would hardly matter if I did, said Sophia. You do as you please. You always have.
She paused a minute, then delivered her dart.
That is, you have done as you please so far.
They took their places at the table, handsome with its array of spode plates and cut crystal stemware. Dieter said, Is your room pleasant, Sophia?
It's very pleasant, Papa, as long as the wind doesn't come up. How a corner room makes the wind whistle.
Well, that's it. It's a corner, so the wind will catch on it as it changes direction, said Andrew. It doesn't bother me. The maid brought in a tureen of carrot soup, hot and spicy. Conversation lagged, caught for a few minutes on Perry's claim for the pole, died away, touched on weather, on Andrew's house being built by a local man with modernist ideas, on James Barterwolf's new Model T Ford. I don't know why anyone wants to go 100 miles an hour, said Dieter. It's folly. Father, if you tried an automobile, I think you would see its advantages. What, go rocketing along by pressing one's foot on a knob? I find the idea effete. A man needs to acquire horsemanship, needs to hold the reins. There is something to be said for the skill of handling and riding horses, agreed James Barterwolf, who was an indifferent equestrian but an avid collector. But I am more interested in weapons. I recently acquired 2 Zulu shields said to be from the Asandlwana battle. The conversation stuttered along. James Barterwolf asked Harkus, What are the main features of your new house?
Automobiles, houses, is not money our subject, said Sophia in her offensive drawl. I wonder we have not had a hash-through of the values of stocks and bonds, the excoriation of New York banks.
Yes, and as to that, said Dieter, pleased with the subject and missing the irony, I propose a toast to Chicago. I daily rejoice that we settled here, not in New York. Only look at the differences in the last panic. New York was in turmoil. Banks and trusts failed. That fellow at Knickerbocker Trust. But in Chicago, we had a central clearinghouse and a special bank examiner to keep an eye on liquidity. The New York institutions fell short in these respects, as well as on liquidity. That's when old Morgan had to push his way in and save the day. Some, said James Barterwolf, say panics are unavoidable side effects of a free market. And there are those who say such events are the fault, not of the free market, but of unscrupulous individuals and unregulated proceedings, and that the only way to avoid periodic panics and financial failures is to have a government-controlled national bank, as most European countries do. I expect there will be a time when that will come to pass, though I doubt I'll see it, said Dieter. Over the almond pudding, Dieter said, Andrew, Charlie was asking me about the West Coast operation, the Redwood and Cedars. He wonders,
I was hoping we could have a family dinner without talk of trees or forest management, interrupted Sophia, disappointed that the discussion of money had turned into a review of a distant New York panic.
She enjoyed hearing about the company's increasing value, thanks to Andrew. As she had secured Andrew, it followed that she was the source for the company's improving fortunes. But there is no better subject than trees, put in Harkus. For this timber family, it is the bread-and-butter subject. James Barterwolf reached for the wine decanter, poured, and then leaned back in his chair until it creaked ominously. He said, Now, timberland discussion gets very hot if Brother Charlie is on hand. He knows everything about logging and forest management, but does not condescend to speak until a mistaken apprehension is uttered, and then he comes with sword and pistol and lays us all low. Harkus decided to laugh, a staccato bark, and Charlie brushed his nose, his feet danced on the floor. He said, James Barterwolf, I am indebted to you for your deep insights. I quite understand why you are such a success at the bar. James Barterwolf, who did in fact drink rather much, turned maroon and half stood, dropping his napkin atop his pudding. James Barterwolf, said Dieter, you and Charlie are not to start wrangling. Caroline, please tell us how the babies are doing. She turned, raised her eyebrows as if surprised by the question.
Why, as well as they might do.
Charlie studied Caroline Breitsprecher. She was attractive, even beautiful, a florid brunette, slightly plump, with gray eyes that were shrewd and penetrating. She looked at Charlie, half-smiled, and tipped him a wink. He felt an electric current of desire. She had deliberately winked at him. Immediately he decided that she was a flirt and that he'd see how far she would go. His imagination jumped into bed with her. To fuck James Bardewolf's wife would be a double pleasure. He almost returned the wink. But he said nothing of forests nor travel, even when questions were put to him. The next day he had that meeting with Dieter to explain how he was supposed to contribute to company capital. He had no doubt that James Bardewolf and Sophia, who both sat on the board, were the primary sources of Dieter's summons that he return. The spring wind off the lake was unseasonably cold. As Charlie hurried along the street with his head down, he put one large Breitsprecher hand over each stinging ear. He lingered in the lower entrance foyer of the Duke building to get warm, putting off the coming discussion with his father. He climbed the stairs, so many polished oak stairs. He counted 40. Would they someday put in an elevator? He entered the familiar office where Miss Heinrich, older than the Redwoods, smiled bravely at him.
"Go right in, Mr. Charlie," she whispered. "I'll bring some coffee."
There sat Dieter at his desk, more of a table than a proper desk. Dieter waved at the chair on the other side of the table. His bald head caught the morning light. Charlie wondered what he did to make it shine so. Dieter plunged directly in. "I'm happy to say that many of my earlier ideas on forest care and management have become today's practice. I was pleased when Roosevelt created the Bureau of Forestry after that vicious affair with the Western senators who thought they'd scored well by forcing the abolishment of the forest reserves. That just got Roosevelt's dander up, and he sequestered a hell of a lot of forest. The reserve system was always wide open to tinkering. It hardly slowed Weyerhaeuser down. Now he, too, is a colossus like Frick and Morgan. For years I have been saying that if forest lands are to be protected, there must be central government control. We are moving in that direction." He named his new heroes: Bernard Fernow, who headed up the forestry school at Cornell, and a main man, Austin Carey, who struggled to make obstinate lumbermen and landowners grasp some basic forestry principles, and George Perkins Marsh, his old American ideal. Dieter said, "And what did you think of the German forests you saw? Did you look out our family connection to Graf von Rothstein?" "I did make a search for that relative. No success. I was told the family died out some time ago." Dieter snorted. He was proof that at least one distant family member survived, and of course the same blood ran in his children's veins. "Tell me what you thought of the forests." "I saw many, many plantations of pine in orderly rows, but I did not consider them to be forests." "Indeed. Then what, in your consideration, is a forest?" Charlie said slowly, "I am sure that wild natural woodlands are the only true forests. The entire atmosphere, the surrounding air, the intertwined roots, the humble ferns and lichens, insects and diseases, the soil and water, weather. All these parts seem to play together in a kind of grand wild orchestra. A forest living for itself, rather than the benefit of humankind." He stopped. "I see. Living for itself. Yes, of course, but that is not managed land, where we plant and watch over trees to provide revenue to the owners, lifetime jobs to workers, shade and pleasure to nature lovers. Wild forests cannot be managed. That is why we cut them and benefit from their wood, then replace them with trees. Trees that can be managed. Your idea of a forest living for itself is not part of modern life. This is what Austin Carey is trying to teach, that timber can be grown as a crop that makes a good profit and can be renewed endlessly.
On one side, he has to persuade the men who want to cut as they always have and who see his talks as a tax to ruin their business. On the other side are people not unlike you who see the end of the forests, disaster for the rivers, even changes in the weather. He has to convince them that forest crops are the way to keep a steady supply and control erosion. They heard the light ticks of sleet on the window glass. Dieter narrowed his eyes. Chicago had long, hard winters, and was it possible this one was persisting so deeply into spring? It was possible. Charlie seemed not to notice the sleet, but talked on in his low voice. I see little merit in rows of pine trees. There is no diversity, and the vaunted utility is an illusion. What of the rural people who once went to the wild forest for 100 reasons? Why do we assume they have no rights to continue their traditional woodland familiarities? He noticed the fine layer of dust on everything in Dieter's office. Globe, bookshelves, chair rungs, window ledges. There was dust on Dieter's ideas. Charlie, you are missing my point. Here in America, the cast of mind is fixed on taking all. My plea for replanting is still a peculiar idea to them. You may be right to say the old wild forests are imperiled, but this is unfortunately a matter of politics. You are wrong, too, when you say German forests are only managed plantations. There are no people in Europe as passionate for wild forests as the Germans. In you, I see that Germanic streak, partly romantic, partly rebellious, and I wish you could understand that there are hidden complexities in the managed forest of which you know nothing. A pity you cannot grow barkless planks. It is no use, Father. I have seen what I have seen and cannot accept tree plantations as a greater good. He could see Dieter was working himself up. His bald pate shone red, and he pinched his lips in and out. Then you had better become a botanist. Dieter spat out the word. And continue your adventuring. He got up and left the office. Charlie waited. Dieter's anger was rare, but he was angry now. His temper would not last, never did last. He would come back. And in a while, Charlie heard the outer door open, heard Dieter say something to Miss Heinrich, heard her answer. He came in, spicules of melting ice on his shoulders. He nodded at Charlie, drew out a bottle, went to the cupboard and took out two glasses, poured for himself and Charlie. Forgive me, Charlie. He swallowed some whiskey. Sighed. I had ideas and feelings similar to yours when I was young, but over the years I learned that the entrepreneurial spirit of this country could not be dampened. We can't be wild animals. We are humans. We live in a world that is a certain way, and forests must adapt to the overwhelming tide of men with axes, not the reverse. I came to believe that planting trees was a kind of forest continuation, not perfect, but better than stumpland. We call such plots forest, and we believe that is what they are. Also, I have never thought that German management could be less than superior. Father, it reeks of the 18th century. It no longer fits. It is also true that there is too much cutting. The old forests are going, and once they are gone, we will have to wait 1,000 years or more to see their like, though nothing will be allowed such a generous measure of time to grow. Most wild American woodlands have already been savaged. Dieter inhaled whiskey and erupted in spasmodic coughs. When he recovered, tears streaming, he changed the conversation and said, "Why don't you tell me what you have seen in your travels?"